With every moment, her beauty became more apparent, and her expressive eyes touched the heart more than the songs of the slaves. Everyone was enchanted, especially the prince, who called her his little foundling. And she danced again, all the more eager to please him, even though each time her foot touched the floor, it felt as if she had stepped on sharp knives. Fairy tales are not exactly a bed of roses, especially the ones told by Hans Christian Andersen. In fact, many of Andersen's stories are fraught with pain and unhappiness. What are we to make of them? I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is University of the Air. With me is Scott Meller, professor of Scandinavian Studies and Folklore Studies in the Department of German, Nordic, and Slavic Studies at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
Hans Christian Andersen, we still, I think, after all these years, tend to see him sort of soft focus and overlook a lot of the more, painful aspects of the things he describes, such as what we just heard from The Little Mermaid.
I think so, for a couple of reasons. I think we tend to look at just a few of his stories rather than his whole oeuvre. And I also think that sometimes we don't even bother to read the stories. We read either retellings or we see the Disney version. And if you watch the Disney version, boy, you get a very different idea of what Andersen is like.
He's writing in the early 19th century, roughly speaking, the middle third of the 19th century, I guess. And is this a time when fairy tales and childhood in general become of greater interest to readers?
I think very much so. I think it's always been interesting that Andersen is born in 1805, the very year that Goethe calls forth the age of Romanticism. And he, of course, remains very much a Romantic writer, though he is also very innovative and tries some different kinds of things in his writings as well. I think we also sometimes misunderstand and think that Romanticism only means things that are good. And Andersen certainly pushes that, you know, that the good and the beautiful is true is certainly an aspect of Romanticism. But sometimes Andersen likes to play with the fact that the bad and the ugly are also true.
And sometimes it's a matter of conversion or the ugly being just a phase that someone goes through. Witness The Ugly Duckling, for example.
Exactly. The Ugly Duckling, I think, is a very interesting story. I don't know. When I ask my students, what do you think of The Ugly Duckling? They think of the usual, that you've got a person who, where we've taken a certain notion about what we think that person is going to be like, and we've projected it on, and then it, of course, even influences the way the person thinks themselves. Already from the beginning, in The Ugly Duckling, you have the mother saying, well, there's something wrong with the egg. And she, you know, is ready to, well, okay, the egg cracks and the duck swims and it's like the other one, so it must be okay. But is slowly brought around to thinking that there's something wrong because everyone else says, no, it can't be right. There's something wrong with him. He's ugly. He's too big. And it becomes a very interesting story of conformity in an era when conformity was the rule. I wonder sometimes whether our students really need that lesson.
There is this kind of push-pull, it seems to me, in Romanticism between conformity and standing out.
Absolutely. And Andersen certainly stood out in his lifetime.
Yes, even the barest outlines very quickly reveal a person who has definitely had his inner conflicts and, from the standpoint of conformity, his quirks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He starts out as the son of a shoemaker who is not even allowed to rise up in society because he can't afford to buy into the guilds, which were the order of the day. They weren't a poor family relative to early 19th century, but they certainly weren't a rich one either, living in maybe a couple hundred square feet, which included their living space and the shoemaker office, if you will. And then he almost acts as his own PR man already at an early age. He knows that he's a good singer, and sometimes he knows that there's somebody listening on the other side of the wall. So he'll sing as though he's just singing to himself, knowing very well that there's somebody on the other side of the wall. I think at a very early age, he realized, I want something more. And that wasn't very usual for the 19th century, at least not that we know of.
Is he caught up at all in the burgeoning Industrial Revolution the way somebody like Charles Dickens, his contemporary, would be?
Absolutely. A story that I will perhaps read a little later on, Grief, deals with exactly those issues of social change. He comes to Copenhagen at a time when Copenhagen is still a medieval walled city. And by the time he's coming to the close of his life in 1870s, it's something of an industrial city. The walls have come down. It's a very different city than he came to when he was a boy of 14 years old.
How well does he fit in with his peers?
Not very well. Not very well at all. He is in some ways completely outside the system. This is a very hierarchical system where you're born to a class and you remain in that class for the rest of your life. And it isn't that Anderson rises up in the social hierarchy. It is that he's completely in some ways out of the system altogether.
And the name, that E-N ending of Anderson, is that indicative of a class status at all?
Absolutely. Anyone whose name ended in S-E-N was seen as being very lower class. The aristocracy in, not just in Denmark, but in Scandinavia in general, tended to have more German-sounding names, like von, if you were of the noble classes. And if you were S-E-N, then you were the son of Anders, and that meant a very much lower class.
And what are his opportunities then by the time he is in his teens? What are, I guess you could say, his opportunities and his needs?
I think on average, a boy like him would have been expected to continue in his father's footsteps as a shoemaker. Anderson, at a young age, decides he doesn't want to do that, so he goes to Copenhagen and eventually makes himself known to some of the people who are higher up in society, and they take him under their wing and are willing to educate him, but not to be an artist. They think that he can rise all the way up to civil servant. That's what their expectation is. So that would have been a significant rise in status from where he was, and that would have been enough, but it wasn't enough for him.
Material status. But he has this artistic temperament?
He does. And of course, it's interesting to think, how did he get that? There are some who have suggested that if he had been born in any other city other than Odense, which is at the time the second largest city in Denmark, and the only other city that has a theater, that perhaps Anderson wouldn't have become Anderson. But there was a theater in Odense, and his father liked the theater and brought young Anderson to the theater. And so at a very young age, he describes himself, how he would put on plays and performances in his house. And that, at the end of the day, is what he wanted to do when he went to Copenhagen. He decided he wanted to work in his beloved Royal Theater in Copenhagen. So he goes, and again, I remind you, he's, I think, 14 at this time. He goes at the age of 14 in 1819, and he gets to Copenhagen and decides, I'm going to work in the Royal Theater. He has one letter of introduction, and it's to a ballet teacher, and he goes there, and he dances for her. And she thinks he's a lunatic and says, you can come on Fridays and have a meal, but no. And so then he proceeds for several weeks to knock on doors until one day he comes to the door of a Mr. Giuseppe Siboni, who has himself recently come there from Italy to teach singing. And there's a dinner party that night. And Anderson himself describes how he kneels down in the stairwell and prays to God that this is going to be the one, because otherwise, what's he going to do? Go back to Odense, failure, or what? And so he goes and manages to convince the cook to let him in. I mean, I think about the amount of both chutzpah he has, but also how much charm he must have had to convince people to let him into this dinner party of, if you will, muckety-mucks from the Royal Theater.
What did he do there?
He started to sing. And, of course, Siboni said, this kid's got some talent. So he said, come and I'll give you some training and I'll give you some bit roles in the Royal Theater.
Well, that's not bad.
Not bad for 2 weeks. Not bad at all. I will say there was a little hiccup in the continuation of his role in the Royal Theater, and that was what happened at around 1617 when his voice cracked.
Well, sure. Transition for all of those wonderful boy singers.
Exactly. So that wonderful soprano voice was no more. And that led to another crisis.
So what's he going to do?
He manages to convince again a group of very wealthy and influential people in Denmark to sponsor him to go to school. And that is a man by the name of Jonas Collin, who is a very good man to know because it turns out he runs the king's government. So not a bad person to know at all. And Jonas says, I will pay for you to go to school. And now he's around 18, 19 years old. But he now has to do the equivalent of going from 19 years old to being in junior high school with all the young kids. And that didn't go over very well
either. So again, he's on the outside.
So again, he's very much on the outside. And when he gets there, he decides that he's going to read some of the failed plays that he had written for the headmaster, who is not impressed at all.
What is the failure of the plays? I mean, it's easy to say it's not that good, but is it a failure of being able to shape a dramatic scene? Is it a failure of character development, a failure of language? Why does this future great storyteller fail as a playwright?
It's really a failure of language. The people who were reading it recognized that there was talent there, but it was barely Danish. It wasn't written well, from a point of view of mechanics.
He just wasn't quite literate enough.
He wasn't literate enough. He had a very elementary education. He at a very young age stopped his education and hadn't continued.
Well, where can he go from there?
Where can he go from there, indeed? So he goes to Schlagose, this high school, this high school for really the cream of Copenhagen. Meisling, the headmaster, is not happy that he's there at all, but what's he going to do after all? Jonas Collin is the one who sent him, and he gives him a very hard time. And apparently, according to Anderson himself, it was a very miserable time for him because the headmaster put a lot of pressure on him and eventually asks him to come and live in the house with him. And of course, this is terrible. This is living with a troll. This is just absolutely terrible.
I seem to recall that Anderson, throughout his life, had nightmares about Meisling.
That's exactly right. And it's really very interesting and telling, too, that those nightmares, they last literally until the moment when he stops writing. We don't know whether he kept on thinking about it after he stopped writing, but he wrote diaries all the way up to the last days of his life, and then he was presumably dying of cancer, and he was brought to the house of the Melchiors, and she continued to write a diary for him, but at that point he wasn't confiding in her his dreams, but one can almost imagine that they lasted to the very end. And he would also mix up Meisling and Collin, because he felt very dependent on Collin. So he could mix them up, even though Collin was the benefactor and Meisling was the tormentor.
The malefactor, yeah.
Yeah, the malefactor, yes.
How does he get out of that relationship?
Well, he writes letters to Jonas Collin and says, this isn't going very well. I'm feeling persecuted. And Jonas Collin writes back essentially saying, well, suck it up. you're getting an education. Why are you complaining? And finally, Jonas Collin gets so fed up with it, he sends kind of a spy to see how bad things actually are. And the spy, or Mr. Müller, comes back and says, no, it is as bad as Anderson is saying. And at that point, he's almost finished with his equivalent of high school anyway. So Collin says, why don't you come back to Copenhagen and we'll give you private tutors for the rest of your education.
Does that give him the boost that he needs then to get into some form of drama?
It does, but at this point, he's still not being groomed by them to be an artist. He's being groomed to be a civil servant. He goes to the university, and I think the expectation might be that, well, perhaps you could become a minister. That was not an uncommon thing for writers at that time to do because it allowed for some freedom to write. But at the end of his university education, he's told by Colleen that perhaps you should apply for a royal grant to go on the grand tour to fill out your education. Again, think about that. So he's being told by very likely the person who's going to give him the grant, even though it's a royal grant, you should apply to that grant.
Sounds promising.
Sounds very promising. He goes on this grand tour, meets a lot of artists in Germany, France, and in Italy. And when he comes back, he says, people are no longer going to tell me what to do. I'm not going to be a civil servant. I'm going to be an author. And that very year, he writes his first novel and his very first small volume of short stories.
How did it go?
It went very well. Well, it went pretty well. Of course, Anderson always focused on the negatives. And there were some critics who thought his improvisatore novel wasn't quite up to snuff. But it really hit some pretty good reviews, by and large. And at some point, there is a literary person who comes to him and says, Anderson, your novels are going to make you famous, but your short stories, they're going to make you immortal.
Somebody knew what he was talking about.
Somebody knew what he was talking about.
He can make a living, though, already?
Well, it's very difficult to make a living as an author.
Still is.
And so he really gets he continues to get support from patrons. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why he has those nightmares that mix up Colleen and Meisling, because of that sense of dependency. He never owns a house. He just has some rooms in an area of Copenhagen called Nyhavn, which is still there today. But he has remarkable access to royalty, to upper bourgeois families. And that's what's so really, quite frankly, amazing is that this poor boy from Odense has this kind of access to so many people and becomes well known throughout Europe.
What kind of personal life is he having?
That's a good question. Well, first of all, even though I would say that he was being very successful, he never felt as though he was being very successful. He continually would complain about the fact that, well, his audience doesn't really understand what he's trying to do. I'm not sure that that's true. I think his audience sometimes very well understood, and he likes to jab at his audience as well. And as with all things, I'm sure they understood some things and didn't understand others. But his personal life, well, that is very difficult because there's been a lot of, there have been quite a few works over the last few years about his possible sexuality, which in the 19th century, you know, even marriage isn't something we would necessarily recognize today. Marriages, if she has three goats and you have 5 acres, let's get these two together. And then if you have possible desires towards someone of your own sex, that is largely illegal. So that's very difficult.
So he was a little ambiguous in that regard?
I think he was very ambiguous in that regard. He did propose to several women, but there is a colleague of mine, Dag Hede, who has noticed that he tended to propose to the sisters of men that he liked.
Well, you could argue that the male friendship was an entree to the sisters.
You could. You could. But one thing, when The Little Mermaid was written, it was written at a time when Edvard Colleen, that's Jonas's son, and Anderson and Edvard were close friends. But Edvard was going to get married. And the family said that they thought it would be best if he did not attend, and they sent him to the countryside because they thought he would make too much of a stink. And it was largely because of his feelings towards Edward. And there have been some who have looked at pieces of The Little Mermaid and seen some echoes of some of that in The Little Mermaid. Anderson, though, is a good writer. And I guess what I mean by that is I'm very hesitant to go the direction of finding biographical criticism in everything that he writes, because that gets very tedious very fast.
It does, doesn't it? It does. The biographical and the psychological both can undersell the material.
I think so. If you're a good author, you're using pieces of your life to create a piece of art that transcends that kind of one-to-one relationship to everything that's happening in your life. And I think Anderson is very much that.
Well, let's look into some of these stories when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Scott Miller, and we're talking about Hans Christian Andersen, the great Danish 19th century writer, not just of stories, but as it turns out, of novels and other things, well, dramas as well. You mentioned that story, The Nightingale, Scott, and when I hear that word nightingale, of course, I think of singing, and you mentioned that Andersen was, as a young man, till his voice broke, a very capable singer, that was sort of his entree into society at first. What's the connection between that, if any, and this story, The Nightingale?
Well, I think, as I mentioned before, that Andersen picks up small little threads out of his life and then makes and builds a story around them that are often much more complicated than this sort of one-to-one biographical. But a couple of notes that one hears in this that come from his life, maybe those little sands that become the pearl. One of them is that when he would sing, knowing full well there were people on the other side of the wall that were listening to him, he did become known in Odense as the little Finnan Nightingale. So one can almost hear a little echo of that in the story. And, of course, he also knew Jenny Lind, the Swedish singer.
How did he get to know her? Because she was a mega celebrity.
She was. If memory serves, she's even invited to the United States by P.T. Barnum.
Oh, she did a tour, a U.S. tour, until things got so out of hand that she left and she donated the $10,000 to charity. This was in 1850.
Well, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, but yeah, so she, yeah, literally was a megastar, and of course knew many, many people in Europe, including Robert and Clara Schumann. She helped them out when they were in tight straits. So how did Hans Christian Andersen get to know her?
She had come down to Copenhagen, and they had gotten to know each other at a dinner party, and he became very enthralled with her, and he himself wrote in his diaries that he felt as though she had had something of a similar trajectory that he had had. She'd come from relative obscurity. She wasn't from a wealthy family. Somebody from above, hierarchically, had sort of plucked her out, recognized her talent, and then she had become this world-famous singer. So she had he had an opportunity to meet her and became very infatuated with her. And as a matter of fact, here we have one of the women that Andersen proposed to where there wasn't a brother involved. He had apparently thought that it'd be nice if they were to get married. And at another dinner party, there was a Dane who had stood up and in a toast had remarked that all Danish men, Jenny, would like to be your brother. And she had stood up and said, well, all Danish men might be too many, but I will take one to represent them all. Hans Christian Andersen, will you be my brother?
Oh, great. And how did he feel about that?
He thought that was a wonderful way to be rejected. Rejection without rejection.
It's the kind of the most common form, isn't it? You know, oh, I think of you as a brother.
I think of you as a brother. Exactly. But the story so has those little tiny sand kernels, but if you read the story, it really becomes this very eloquent, romantic text that has some of the typical kinds of techniques that you see in Romanticism. One of the things the Romantics liked was this interplay between nature and culture, and I think you can see that in this text.
What's the premise of the story?
The premise of the story is that we have an emperor, and one day he discovers that there is this thing called a nightingale that apparently sings beautifully, and he doesn't know anything about this nightingale, but he wants to find out about it. I think one of the things, if you listen to this quote, I think you can kind of get a feel for some of the romanticism in the text. They're talking about a forest. The forest stretched all the way to the sea, which was blue and so deep that even large boats could sail so close to the shore that they were shaded by the trees. Here lived a nightingale who sang so sweetly that even the fishermen who came every night to set its nets would stop to rest when he heard it and say, "Blessed God, how beautiful it sings." But he couldn't listen too long, for he had work to do, and soon he would forget the little bird. Yet the next night, when he heard it again, he would repeat what he had said the night before, "Blessed God, how beautiful it sings." So here we're introduced to this nightingale, and we are also introduced to the notion that it's sort of the people of the lower classes that know about it. When the king when the emperor finds out that there's this thing called a nightingale, they seek out the little kitchen maid, again, going to the lower classes. Sort of one of these hallmarks of romanticism, this idea of elevating the peasantry to some sort of nobility. So you have him who is noble, and you have them who are sort of elevated to this status.
Have a kind of a natural nobility about them.
The natural nobility about the peasants.
Yes.
That natural nobility is that this is the age of romanticism, the age where we are trying to discover what it means to be German or what it means to be Danish or what it means to be Swedish. And how do we do this, ask the philosophers. Well, you don't go into the classroom because they're too influenced by Latin. So you have to go to the real people, and the real people are, of course, the peasants. It's a little pejorative, though, because, you know, we're sort of observing them to extract culture from them. But that was the times. In a sense, this all starts out with people like, well, philosophically, it starts out with people like Herder. But he's the one who says we need to go out and get it from the people. And, of course, it's the Brothers Grimm who heed that call first. They're, quite frankly, interested in linguistics and looking at the German language or German languages, as it may be. And then they come out with a treatise on German language, but then they also come out with the Brother Grimm fairy tales. Shortly after that, in Denmark, a man by the name of Matthias Winter decides he's going to do the same thing. But it doesn't seem to take as well in Denmark. The stories are felt to be a little bit flat. They're a little bit terse. People aren't so very interested in them. But Andersen, who grew up with these fairy tales, thought, I know how to transform those oral stories, which you're not really getting on the page, into a written story. And that was really, to begin with, some of what he was so very good at doing.
Is The Nightingale a story that puts him then on the map?
The Nightingale comes out really in, 1843, so it doesn't really put him on the map. He's already on the map at this point. About 6 or 7 years earlier, he had come out with another story, another slim volume of stories that included some fairy tales that he had heard when he was a kid, but also included tales that make fun of the fairy tale. The Princess and the Pea, for example, which isn't a real fairy tale. Andersen is poking fun of the genre he himself is sort of using or writing. And then Little Ida's Flowers, which is a story where he wants to have us know that this is completely my own creation. This isn't a spoof or anything. This is where my real expertise will shine. And it is a very good story.
You see the lot in music of the time and even a little bit later, too, where sometimes folk music is included in, say, a classical work, but sometimes it just sounds like folk music. So
right.
Sometimes it's an original thing that the composer has been inspired to write based on his or her experience with folk music.
Exactly. And of course, this is there isn't really a concept of plagiarism at this point in the way that we think of it. There is the idea that one should slowly become original, but authors are readily borrowing from each other. And again, if you're taking from the folk tradition, you're just really kind of pilfering it, if you will. So stories like The Emperor's New Clothes, a story that he, if you will, pilfered from folk tales. He changes the story Big Pear and Little Pear to Little Claws and Big Claws, and he removes some of the sex and violence out of it because, you know, we the folk can get a little raunchy sometimes. Still keeping a fair amount in there, but a lot of it is taken away. And then, of course, he comes up with these stories like The Nightingale, which are not from folklore, but you might think they are. Or the Ugly Duckling, which is, again, something that you might think is from folklore. Or The Little Mermaid, which you quoted from in the beginning, where it almost goes the other direction. Here we have a very complicated tale. And then Disney comes along and re-folklorifies it, if you will.
Takes it back to a simpler, overall a sweeter look than what we find in Hans Christian Andersen.
Exactly. I remember quite a while ago when my niece was very young, she loved when the movie Little Mermaid came out. She loved that story. And I didn't at the time think of how cruel it was, but for Christmas, I gave her the complete Andersen, and she was so excited. "Oh, now I have it," she said. "And which story should I read first?" "Well, The Little Mermaid," I said. So she ran into her room. She wasn't even finished opening all of her presents, but she ran into her room, and she opened it up and started reading it, and she came out, and she looked very perplexed. And I said, "Well, did you like it?" And she said, "I'm not sure."
Didn't square with what she was expecting.
Not at all, not at all. Because, of course, Disney has made it into a magic tale, back to a magic tale where you have a happy ending and the girl gets the prince. And spoiler alert if you haven't read it, but that's not how The Little Mermaid ends. As a matter of fact, The Little Mermaid dies and she becomes foam on the sea and we have a resurrection story at the end. Because the true quest that the Little Mermaid is out for is an immortal soul, not the prince at all.
Which isn't exactly a child's storyline.
I don't think so at all.
Even in the early 19th century.
I don't think so at all. And that echoes back to this notion that Andersen tried to fight against, especially later on, that he was not just a children's storyteller. People sometimes called him a children's storyteller. There's even a legend, I don't know if it's true or not, but it holds a grain of truth, that in the later years of his life, they were going to erect a statue of him in the middle of Copenhagen. That statue now exists. And originally, there were going to be children at his feet. He sits there on a chair with a book in his hand. There were going to be children at his feet, and he is purported to have said, "I don't want those children there. I don't even like children." Which, of course, was not true. He did like children, but he didn't like the idea that he should only be recognized as a children's writer.
How were his stories, including the novels, actually marketed in the 1840s? Are they marketed, any of them, as this is a volume of children's stories versus this is a volume of stories?
Some of them in the early days are marketed as children's stories, and later on, children is dropped and they're called things like legend or just plain stories. Eventyr is what they're called, which is basically just a sort of a story word, a word for just plain stories. They certainly were stories, and he recognized them as stories. And it was also interesting to hear other people remark that when they would invite him to their house, the expectation was he would read or tell the stories. And he would tell some of them, and he would read others. So he understood the sort of fluidity between the literary and the oral.
Are his stories such that they lend themselves to reading out loud?
Many do. Many lend themselves to being retold. I think you can easily retell, for example, The Ugly Duckling.
Sure.
You don't have to read it. Some of them, like The Snow Queen, really have to be read because they're so long and involved. But he and a couple others, in a way, are responsible for renovating, if you will, or reorganizing the Danish language. I mean, the Danish language, like many languages of the 18th century, you know, where paragraph and sentence become one,
yes,
where every sentence has 15 or 16 clauses. I exaggerate only by a little.
Well, look at the beginning of A Scarlet Letter from 1850.
I
think the whole first paragraph is one sentence with a lot of semicolons.
Exactly,
I think.
Exactly. And he uses very short, snippy sentences. You know, this is the thing I have as a problem with some of the translations. There's one translation, unfortunately, I don't have it with me, where it's in the tinderbox, where the tinderbox starts, there was a soldier coming back from war. One, two, or maybe hut, two, however we want to translate that. And this translation says, a soldier was coming back from war and presently he met a witch. It's like, who talks like that?
Yeah, so it can be a disconnect between the written and the oral.
Absolutely.
But they have they do have an oral storyteller kind of nature to them, these stories, either way, then.
They do. I think they lend themselves very much to being read. Yeah.
And as far as I mentioned Charles Dickens earlier, his contemporary, as Hans Christian Andersen becomes more famous, an international figure, I assume. I mean, Denmark is right in the middle of Europe, small country. It's inevitably going to spill over if you're any writer at all. How does he compare with Dickens then? Both of them, as we said, you know, lower class, industrial revolution, and kind of rising to the top to tell about it.
Well, you know, they met. Didn't go very well. Andersen thought it went wonderfully, but it didn't go particularly well. He came to England. The first time he came to England, they met for just a few moments, and Dickens invited him back. So Andersen came back, but he stayed too long. He insisted the sons shave him. So there were all these kinds of faux pas that were done. And so when he left, he wrote Dickens a newspaper article length thank you in the newspaper, which got then translated. And he also discussed how idyllic the Dickens household was. And of course, Dickens was on the verge of having a divorce. So Dickens didn't appreciate that at all. But in terms of their literature, I almost think that Andersen was better known than Dickens initially. Dickens would have been better known in the English-speaking world, but Andersen was much better known in the German-speaking world and to some degree in the French-speaking world as well. He became translated into a number of different languages almost right away. Again, it was his novels that got translated first and his tales got translated later. And then when his tales did get translated, that's what elevated him considerably, and people all over Europe would invite him to their homes just to come and see the man.
Did he pretty much then stick with the stories once he became so successful with those?
He did them all throughout his entire career. He did he wrote novels. He wrote short stories. I mean, he wrote 186 short stories. He also wrote plays, which few people either perform today or see. Obviously, you can't see them if you don't perform them, and they're pretty good. I would say that his plays stand some of the test of time. His tales absolutely do, and I would say that his novels are the ones that I don't have anybody read.
Well, so what's the difference in terms of longevity?
Well, the novels are outdated. They were sort of this older Bildung form, which basically means that you're describing this journey through life, and it's usually a young man, and, you know, Goethe sort of perfected this form.
Werther, yeah.
Exactly. So you have somebody like Faust who grows up, makes some bad decisions, you know, selling your soul's never considered a good decision.
Bad move.
A good woman usually comes in and saves the day, again, using Faust as the example, and then the man hopefully learns from his mistakes, marries often the woman or another woman, and then is reintegrated into society. They're kind of a little formulaic and dated with regard to the way that we think of the world, whereas the stories describe the human condition and many of its aspects that are still relevant today. And of course, he wrote bad stories too.
Did he?
Some of his stories I don't teach anymore. Don't ask me which ones because I don't think about them. You know, even if we will, the Snow Queen, I think, has its flaws. I wouldn't condemn it as a bad story. But there's something that just doesn't quite work at the end of the story. The Snow Queen is a story told in several parts. It starts out with this wonderfully playful component whereby the devil has made a mirror
Yes.
And the little demons think that, won't this be great fun? The mirror shows the opposite of what's looking at it. So, you know, you show a forest and you see broccoli. And, of course, kids get that right away. So there is this double language with kids in many of Anderson's stories, too. And then they try to bring it up to God, because won't that be funny? What will the mirror that shows the opposite show if it points to God? So they go up to heaven, and the mirror is laughing, and it's laughing, and all of a sudden it splinters into 1,000 pieces, and all the pieces go across the earth. I personally think that piece right there is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Then we meet two children, Goethe and Kai. And we meet these two children who are sort of next-door neighbors, if you will, but they kind of act as brother and sister. Right. There's a grandmother involved. And Kai is growing up. He gets one of these splinters in his eye, and he only sees things rationally. And now we can have an interesting conversation about this sort of romantic versus enlightenment kind of mindset.
The real versus the ideal.
Exactly. He goes off with the Snow Queen, who, by the way, plays almost no role. So if you're thinking, oh, that's the basis for Frozen, what's the similarities there? And you think to yourself, absolutely nothing, because the Snow Queen's hardly in the story.
She just sort of scoops up these children and whisks them off to her place in the north.
She scoops up Kai, and then Goethe goes trying to find him, and that's the rest of the story, is her growing up story. But the part that doesn't really work for me, at any rate, is you almost have these two voices within this story. One is this Bildung voice that I talked about before, this growing up, coming of age story. And we're following Goethe, so that makes it very innovative, because we're following a girl rather than a boy, which is typical for the Bildung stories. But she doesn't grow up. There's this other sort of voice that comes into it that is almost a pseudo-religious voice. And these voices don't really talk to each other. They don't really negate each other. It just doesn't work at the end. So they come back, and it says very clearly that they've grown up, but they haven't grown up. They've grown taller, but they haven't learned anything. They forget everything that they've learned, and they sit down, and they sing their hymns. And for me, that just... there's something that's just missing there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a buildings roman. It's just a roman.
Yes, just a roman.
Nobody
exactly.
gets built
But
up.
There's brilliant pieces in it. It's just that as the whole, I'm a little unsatisfied.
Well, I suppose that in itself is a little bit romantic, you know, this kind of greatness in ruins where nothing is quite complete, but you get glimpses, a fragment of something great.
You know, I thank you for that. That puts it in the best context. I've never been able to put it in a better context. But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
We're going to look at, in fact, we're going to hear an entire Hans Christian Andersen story, probably one you've never heard or probably never even heard of, for that matter, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Scott Miller. We're looking at the life and the writings of Hans Christian Andersen, the great Danish storyteller of the 19th century, whose stories are very much with us in one form or another. And I've promised that we're going to hear an entire story. And what made you choose this one, Scott?
Over the years, this one is one that I have really grown to like a lot because of its complexity. It's one page long, and yet I keep finding more and more bits in it that I really like. And it's also one of the ones, it's written in 1853. There's a lot of things happening in Denmark in 1853 that are reflected in this story. And I think also can speak to us today. And it isn't really romantic, but it isn't really anything else either. It fits in this, you know, the period in letters that comes after Romanticism in Scandinavia is known as the modern breakthrough, where all literature has some sort of grand social meaning.
Yeah,
this is much before that. And he's getting at issues, But he's certainly not in a modern breakthrough sense getting at issues. We still have that storytelling component, which I enjoy so much.
And the story is?
The story is often translated as grief or heartache. It's called Hjartesorg in Danish. I think heartache works pretty well, but grief is the word in the translation that I have here, and it comes up a couple of times, so we'll call it grief. This is a story in two parts. The first part is not really necessary, but it provides background, and that is always useful. We were visiting friends who lived in a manor house out in the country, and it so happened that while my host was called away for a few days, a woman came by from a nearby town. She had a lap dog along, which she carried under her arm. She had come in order to ask my host to buy stock in her tannery, and she had all her papers with her. I advised her to put them in an envelope and write on the outside my friend's name and titles: War Commissary General, Knight of the Danish Flag, etc. The woman grabbed the pen and began, and then stopped. She asked me to repeat what I had said a little more slowly. I did, and she started to write once more. But in the middle of the word commissary, she sighed and said, "I'm only a woman." Her lap dog, which she had put down on the floor, began to growl. He had been taken along for his health and his amusement, so he thought he wasn't supposed to be put on the floor. He was fat and flat-nosed. "He doesn't bite," said the mistress. "He hasn't got a tooth left in his mouth. He is a member of the family, faithful but bad-tempered, and that's my grandchildren's fault. They like to play getting married, and the dog has to be a bridesmaid, and that tires him out, the poor thing." She left and took the little dog under her arm and went home. That was the first part of the story, that one that could have been skipped. Now, at this point, I'm going to stop for a moment because it says here this is the first part of the story and that it could be skipped. And this is representative of Anderson being a trickster because, of course, it can't be skipped. It's kind of laying the whole foundation for the entire story. This represents, in a sense, the old world. You've got somebody who is clearly an aristocrat with all of his titles, doesn't seem to be home. Our narrator is somebody who sort of negotiates this in the middle. And you have somebody who is not of the lower classes. She has a tannery, after all. She's a widow. And it represents some of the changes that are going on. Now, for the first time, you have this woman who is able to inherit from her husband. And this was a small change in the law. Even this comment, "I'm only a woman," represents that some of the laws are changing. She's also very smart because we're at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And she realizes that in order to compete, she's going to have to innovate. And in order to do that, she's going to have capital. And so she has to go and get this money. So this, it could be skipped. Complete nonsense, because he's dealing with this shifting world, the Industrial Revolution, and the change in government systems, and we're the following year even going to have a change in the guilds. The guilds held control over all the commerce in Denmark, and the following year they were going to abolish the guilds. We were going to have something called free enterprise. This is 53. In 48, they had abolished the absolute monarchy. We now had
a constitutional
monarchy, exactly. So those are the things that are sort of being described here. And the next part, I think Anderson is in a sense posing a question. The lap dog died. That's the second part. It was a week later. He had come to town and had taken a room in an inn. Our windows faced the back of the building, and we had the view of a yard. It was divided in two by a fence. In one half, hides were being hung to dry, both tanned and untanned ones. It was a tannery, and it belonged to the widow, the woman we had met in the manor house. Her lap dog had died that very morning and was being buried in the yard. The widow's grandchildren, that is, the tannery widows, not the lap dog, the lap dog had never been married, were very busy patting the earth smooth on top of the grave. It was a beautiful grave in which it must have been a pleasure to lie. It was fenced by broken flower pots and covered with sand. As the tombstone, there stood a beer bottle with its neck upward. It wasn't meant symbolically. The children danced around the grave, and the oldest of the boys, an enterprising young lad of 7, suggested that they should exhibit the grave to anyone in the street who cared to see it. The entrance fee would be 1 button, for that was something that every boy who wore suspenders owned. And he would even be able to pay for a girl without losing his trousers. Their proposal carried unanimously. All the children in the street and in the alley behind the yard came and paid their buttons. Many a boy had to wear 1 suspender instead of 2, but at least they'd seen the little dog's grave, and that was worth it. Outside the gate of the tannery stood a little girl. Although she was dressed in rags, she was lovely. She had the most beautiful curly hair, and her eyes were so clear and blue that it was a pleasure to look at them. She didn't utter a word, nor did she cry, but every time the gate was open, she peeked in. She didn't own a button, and therefore she stood dejected outside the gate all afternoon, until the last of the children had left. Then she burst out crying and hid her eyes in her little sunburnt hands. She sat down upon the ground. She alone of all the children in the street had not seen the lapdog's grave. Now that was grief, a sorrow as sharp as a grown-up's can be. We saw it from above, and the little girl's sorrow, like many of our own, was laughable when we see it from above. That is the story, and if you haven't understood it, then you can buy stock in the widow's tannery.
Whoa.
You see what Anderson's doing there? Because now we have to wake up a little bit and say, wait a minute, do I need to buy stock? Is that a good thing to buy stock? You know, I think Anderson is suggesting that we had a system before, or the text seems to be suggesting at any rate, that we had a system before of haves and have-nots. And we've now changed our system, and now we have a system of haves and have-nots. And how much has really changed? We hear the language of Parliament, you know, the motion carried unanimously. We see the free enterprise that's being introduced into Denmark. But there's some curious things, too. What exactly are we selling? We're selling death? We're selling viewing the grave? This notion that from above it seems laughable, I don't think that's negated. I don't think it's meant that the sorrow is laughable. I think what's really sort of meant there is that she's sorry about something that's questionable. She didn't get the latest iPad. Is that really something to be sorry for? Of course, her grief is real. It says that. But what is she really sorry for?
Well, but I get the impression she has no direct experience with this dog anyway.
No.
That she's, in a way, sort of being sold a bill of goods.
And she's being left out of that bill of goods.
Right.
She, among all the children,
yes,
is the one who couldn't participate.
Right.
Yeah.
Because she didn't have the button.
Right.
You could go a lot of places with that story, it seems
Absolutely.
To me. I mean, it's kind of like just bare bones enough that all these aspects of it point somewhere else.
And I see so many things in there, and I have a hard time sometimes untangling what might have been there in the 19th century. What am I bringing with me in 2019?
Sure.
You can put your 2019 world right into that.
Well, yeah, that's right. And that we do that all the time, don't we? We look at something from a distant future rather than from the time from whence came these people who are experiencing this story.
And isn't it interesting you use the word distance? Because that's come up twice in this story. First, the distance, social distance between our narrator and the tannery widow. And then the distance of him sitting above, looking below, and that distance as well. That's supposed to presumably give you a bit of that distance, a bit of perspective. But I think that perspective is undercut too.
At the same time, it strikes me as a very wry story.
It is.
I mean, you know, must have been a delightful grave to be lying in if you just happen to be dead anyway.
You can certainly recognize it as an Anderson story because the humor is there.
Well, I wish we had more time to look at more Anderson and more deeply even into that story, grief or heartache, but we have certainly had a great time doing as much as we could.
Well, thank you very much.
And Scott Miller, it has been a great pleasure, and we'll all be looking more closely at our Hans Christian Andersen from now on.
Thank you again.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.